You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Andrew Edlin, director of the Andrew Edlin Gallery. Andrew, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks, Brainerd. Great to be with you.
Andrew, I want to talk to you about a couple of things, your current show and also the Outsider Art Fair. But to begin with, there's a beautiful show you're having now, two shows at your space. And one is called Unaccompanied Conversations, a three-person show. And it's a beautiful show. I've never seen anything quite like this in your space before, and I'm a big fan of your space. Can you tell me a little bit about this show? The sculptures were kind of amazing to look at. I've never seen anything like that. And the drawings, too, were just something beautiful and poetic about all of it.
Sure. Well, this is a show that sort of has been germinating for years. It started, I've been representing the John Byam estate for about a dozen years, who was a completely unknown guy who lived in upstate New York in the Oneonta area. He worked at his family's trailer park, and some of his little wood carvings ended up in a country auction that somebody bought and then traced to the source and got like the guy's entire life body of work. And they approached me at the Outsider Art Fair and said, hey, check this out. And I get approached all the time, but this really struck me. And so I've been showing the work for quite some time, but I always felt that there was a real affinity with James Castle's work, sort of almost like the 3D version of some of Castle's drawings. There's a real sensibility, this humility, this feeling that artists like this are working in a completely unknown rural environments for no audience in particular. And so over the years, I always kind of, it'd be cool to pair those two. And then I started representing the Pearl Blauvelt estate several years ago, and that was also an artist that I thought had affinities with Castle. And James Castle is really the canonical figure of the three. And so, of course, both the owners of the Blauvelt and Byam estates were very titillated by the idea of contextualizing those works with Castle. And I finally put it on the schedule, and it was really exciting because as I was starting to hang the show, you know, as I could see it moving from the hypothetical to the actual, it really surpassed my expectations. So all these artists were, you know, there's such humility in this show. Really, it's got an understated quality, but really earth tones, you know, and it's just, it's a really beautiful show, and I'm really proud of it.
There's something about humility, as you're saying. That's an interesting term to use here. It seems that that's something that you see often in your gallery, or do you feel that the show is an exception to that kind of humility?
No, I think what that the humility aspect of it really relates to the fact that these are really outsider artists in the sense that, of course, they're self-taught. But also that, as is almost always the case with outsider artists, is they're making their work, almost the audience isn't even part of the equation. You know, they're making it, they're sort of creating these their own universes that they would like to inhabit or reflects their lives, and they're not thinking about their show or their dealer or the critics or the museum curators or anything. So it's got this feeling of real unself-consciousness about it, and so that really comes out in these works. And I think that's true of, because my program is mostly self-taught artists, I think that's probably what you're keying into, Brainerd.
And there's another show of Vahak Arslanian in the second space in your gallery. This is really unusual show, and also a very unusual artist, right? The framing of this was like nothing I've ever seen. The imagery and also the artists themselves is in a very unusual position, correct?
He certainly is. You know, this Vahak was really the first artist I ever gave a solo show to. He's in his mid-40s now. But, you know, as a lot of my career in the art world has been very happenstanceical, and when I got my first space in Chelsea, it was sort of like a loft space, and my partner was subletting part of his space to Vahak for a studio, and I was just like, oh my God, I'm interested in outsider art, and this kid is right here. And those frames you're referring to, he buys like airplane window frame, you know, airplane windows from, you know, airplane supply distributors. But Vahak is I guess what we would say these days, neurodivergent. He was severely autistic as a kid, and he doesn't hear or speak. He signs, and which is very interesting because at the same point, and he's self-taught, he grew up in a family that was very acculturated into the art world, and his father was a prominent diamond dealer and art collector and close friends with the Schnabel family. So Vahak at 5 years old was smashing plates in Julian's studio. And so he was represented by Vito Schnabel for a while. And so even though he's really a classic outsider in a lot of ways, his work has sort of been put over in the contemporary art world. And he loves airplane imagery and birds. Those are candles. He has a kind of a limited lexicon in terms of what he does drawings and paintings of. Lately he's been using nail polish, actually, and then he places them into these odd window frames, so it almost has like a voyeuristic quality about it. And you know, I'm just giving him a show. It's a recent work, and I think it came together really nicely, but I feel like it was also a nice pairing with the other show.
And his work, as you said, neurodivergent, he was nonverbal and partially deaf since birth. As I was reading on your site, he also does have some hearing, right? He can, part of the reason we're looking at images of airplanes and birds in his work is because he can hear that somewhat?
You know, I always dealt with him. I mean, functionally, he's completely deaf as far as I've ever experienced. I guess, you know, one of the reasons, you know, some of his symptoms when he was a kid was he was fascinated with smashing things, which sort of fed into the Schnabel thing. I mean, it was, of course, very problematic for his family, but I think it was also because he could get some hearing or feel somehow the vibrations of smashing glass. So, you know, when he communicates, it was strictly sign language, but of course I don't sign, so he just uses the messaging app on his phone. That's how we communicate now. But to the extent that he has any hearing at all, I don't think there's any functionality in it. Maybe he can hear certain frequencies, but as far as I can see, you know, I mean, I've by mistake, when his back is turned, I've been like, you know, forgetting, and I'd call him, and of course he would never turn around or anything. But yeah,
so that's a fascinating connection between the smashing and sound, and also, you know, Schnabel's painting and the whole the art world there. You know, it that's a great story about smashing plates for Julian Schnabel.
Yeah, Julian actually wrote a book called CVJ, where his introduction is basically a portrait of Vahak as a five-year-old. And he also narrated a documentary film on Vahak when Vahak was, I mean, barely into his teens. So that's been sort of an interesting connection. But, you know, I've been showing him for, 20 years now, and following his career, and it's been an interesting ride.
Andrew, you're the owner of the Outsider Art Fair, which is coming up, and I'd love to know more about the Outsider Art Fair and its iteration this year. Of course, after the pandemic, all these things started coming back in different forms, but the Outsider Art Fair is a very special and unique fair because of its specificity, but also there's work there like no other fair.
Well, I would certainly agree with you. You know, most contemporary art fairs, of course, all the artists are, you know, academically trained, so they've looked at the same series of art historical references and studied many of the same techniques. So in point of fact, the work is sort of like part of a big conversation that they're having amongst each other, which is great, and people love that. But the Outsider Art Fair is completely different. None of these artists are working in that kind of conversation, so to speak. And it instead of the Outsider Art Fair feeling like sort of an amalgam of what the art market has to offer, you end up, each booth is sort of like its own eccentric universe. And it's really very exciting in that regard. And we're going into our 32nd year, so it's no fly by night operation.
No, it's not. Congratulations on that. You know, you talked about the conversation in the art world and in the outsider art world, the outsider art fair. As you say, that's not the same conversation, or perhaps there isn't a conversation that way. But what is the dialogue then? Because it's there's a dialogue between dealers at the very least, right? That you're choosing to be in there, that are contributing to the definition of outsider art.
Well, you know, I would say that the fair has been a meeting place for this community, and this community is really evangelical. It's collectors, dealers, curators, scholars, and I think what sort of ties these people together is they've really sort of forgotten about or eschewed the noise and the hoopla of the art world, and they're interested in zeroing in on and kind of obsessing over what they view as the soul of artistic invention. You know, a lot of people would contend that an academic education also acts as a filter. As human beings, we have an instinct to make art that starts when we're children. But then as people who choose to make it a career and go to school, you start to have the eyes of your classmates and your professors. And if you keep going, it's your dealers, the curator, the press. And to remain free of that kind of inspection and is not so easy. It enters into your cosmology, your creativity, what you choose to make. And I think these artists who are self-taught and, you know, don't have that, that's never been part of the equation for them, are freed up in a way. And it tends to lead to work that at its best is, you know, sort of radically individualistic. And I think that's what people key into. You know, I think there's a, when you walk into the Outsider Art Fair, you know there's something different going on than the larger or institutional contemporary fairs. It's just these artists haven't studied the same art historical materials and techniques. They're not making the art for collectors, dealers, the press. It's you can feel the difference.
How has that changed over the course of 30 years, or let's say the last decade or more of outsider art and the Outsider Art Fair? Has the work itself or the conversation in the art world about outsider art changed? Has the acceptance of it or the understanding of it changed?
Yeah, it's really changed tremendously, Brainerd. I think when the Outsider Art Fair started in 1993, the context for outsider art was much more folk art. And since then, folk art, the difference between folk art and outsider art is I think folk artists may be self-taught, but they're working in sort of a traditional imagery, whether it's quilting or duck decoys or certain kinds of furniture, whereas outsider art is really coming much more out of the imagination, the imagery. And so over the years, you know, there have been some real visionary collectors and curators and critics and writers who have really, you know, waved the flag for the outsider art community and genre. And that has sort of helped break down the walls of the larger mainstream art world. So now that whether it's major museums like the Met or MoMA or the Venice Biennale, or David Zwirner or, you know, Hauser & Wirth or whoever, some of the mega dealers and even Christie's, they're all now sort of getting in on the action. And I think that the Outsider Art Fair and the community that is involved with the fair, can take a lot of credit for that, from just relentlessly championing the work, even when there was not so much of a market and it was really coming out of passion. And of course, now it's continuing to gain recognition, especially over the last 10 years, the momentum has been much more palpable.
And because of the kind of embrace, as you just said, of these major institutions in the art world of outsider art and the Outsider Art Fair, does that shift the conversation at all? It's basically academia in a way embracing a non-academic stance, right?
Right. It's a little complicated, you know. I see what's happening is that these players who have now embraced work that they more or less categorically dismissed at one point, you know, I think what happened is that our community just got it from one place to where there's a real canon, there's scholarship and everything else. And I think the financial viability of taking something that's maybe priced at $50,000 and big dealers can say, sprinkle their magic fairy dust on it and turn it into $250,000 is much more of a realistic prospect for them than when there's no market at all and to establish one from scratch. So I think that's what's been happening sort of more on the dealing level. And I think it's problematic for sure in a lot of ways, because a lot of times the big dealers will try and create affinities with academically trained established sort of art stars. They'll try and infer or an affinity between the self-taught artist that they've taken on, and when, of course, there's no relationship at all, just because it's good for business. So, that's art dealing. But it's, our community is out there on the front lines, and when there's a new body of work that's discovered, our guys are usually the ones who are contacted or who are on the case. And so every year something new turns up at the fair. I mean, when you walk through a lot of the big fairs, and listen, I'm a fan. My gallery exhibits at Fries and Basel and so forth. It's a very good place to go do business. But you don't often find something that, like, whoa, what's that? I've never seen that before. You see a lot of the greatest examples of the well-known artists that are in the art world. But at the Outside Art Fair, you just, it's like you turn a corner and you see something you've never seen before in your life. And it's really captivating. You want to learn about who the artist was or where it was found. Maybe it's something totally anonymous, too. But I think we have that going for us that I don't see at other fairs.
Yeah, that's so interesting. You mentioned earlier the difference between folk art and an outsider art as a kind of visionary one, or that's my term, but coming from the imagination, from the artist's head. Is there crossovers in it at all? Is it possible for someone to be schooled that's not self-taught and still be making work that's kind of outside of academia or coming from their head, so to speak?
No, yeah. Absolutely. You know, I mean, categories make life easier for us to talk about art, you know. So when you say outsider art or contemporary art or folk art, but there's gray areas. The lines are blurry. And, I represent several artists that I consider very visionary, like Paulina Peavy and Carla Knight, but they were very well-trained. Carla went to RISD. TV study with Hans Hoffman, amongst other people, and you have that kind of sophistication, of course, but still have vision. So I think that's absolutely possible. And the gray areas make things really more interesting to discuss. I mean, there were some artists that I remember. I represented the Charles Steffen estate for a while, and he was in his first year of art school, so he knew the canon, and then he started hearing voices and sort of descended into schizophrenia, and his work changed radically and had such a bizarre but intense look to it that was really captivating. But he knew the canon before he got ill, and it was still somehow influential on his work. So it's case by case all the way.
Andrew, it's fascinating to talk to you about this, and also exciting to hear about the Outsider Art Fair coming up. Before we go, is there anything you want to say about the Outsider Art Fair? I know I'll be there, and there's links here for people to learn more and get tickets, but is there anything else you want to say about it?
Well, it's February 29th to March 3rd at the Metropolitan Pavilion, and you know, we feature curated spaces every year, and this year we're actually going to have a booth of artwork made by the Beat Generation poets. So I'm really excited about that. Anne Waldman, who's a legendary poet herself, is going to curate it. So there'll be works by Kerouac, Ferlinghetti, Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, and some of the really lesser-known female poets. And then the talk, we always have OAF talks, and this year it's going to be at the New Museum on February 27th, the evening of, and it's going to be called Culture and the Uncultivated, and the panelists are going to include David Byrne and Judith Hamp Korelitz, who wrote the novel The Latecomer recently, and Warren Zanes, who just wrote a book on Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska album and was a member of the 80s band The Del Fuegos. So I think it's going to be a super exciting discussion, and we're going to really talk about this stuff, about the what is it to be a self-taught artist, and what are the differences between self-taught artists and their trained counterparts. So there's going to be a lot to dig in. I think it's going to be exciting.
That sounds very exciting. Andrew, there's links, of course, for the listeners here to dig into more of this information that you've mentioned. Andrew, I want to thank you so much for this talk today and for the Outsider Art Fair and this great show at your gallery.
Brainerd, it's great to be with you, and I appreciate the attention.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.